This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and this is the Woman's Hour podcast. It is Monday, the 3rd of June, 2019. Today, we'll hear about how austerity has, according to our contributor, demonised disabled people. That's Dr. Frances Ryan. You'll hear her in a moment or two. Also on the programme today, the young adult author Juno Dawson, who's written in her most recent book about the modelling industry. And it's called Meat Market, her book, so I guess that tells you a little bit about her view of the modelling industry. We'll also celebrate coaches in women's sport this week, and we'll hear about what it's like to have a child with Down syndrome in Tanzania. First, though, austerity has led to the demonisation of disabled people. This according to the journalist and campaigner Dr. Frances Ryan, who says disabled people are treated these days as worthless scroungers, a drain on the public purse, and they're targeted, she says, to take the greatest cuts. It is worth saying that women are more likely to be disabled. There are around 6.5 million disabled women in Britain, compared to about 5.5 million disabled men. And the Women's Budget Group back in 2018 did find that almost 60% of people claiming personal independence payments are female. So I spoke to Dr. Frances Ryan, who's written her new book, Crippled, and I asked her, first of all, how she defines disabled in her book.
So in the book, I talk about disability as quite a broad term, and I think that's important. So it really includes anyone who's affected by a health condition, whether that's mental health, or a chronic long-term sickness, or a physical disability.
And you are speaking from a position of authority yourself as a wheelchair user.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a wheelchair user, and I've been reporting on disability issues and the impact on cuts for about 7 years now for The Guardian.
We should say right at the start that we do have a statement from the DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions, and they say building a society that works for disabled people will always be a priority for this government. That's why we are spending £55 billion this year on benefits to support disabled people and those with health conditions more than ever before. So that's the DWP line. Your book, to put it mildly, takes issue, I think, with, well, perhaps not with that figure, because that may well be indisputable, but with the way the money is spent. What would you say about that?
So I think it's beyond dispute that the last 7 years have seen deep cuts across the board. We know that austerity has affected anything from, you know, public libraries, social care system, benefits. But when we look at the numbers, it's really disabled people who have been disproportionately impacted by those cuts. So research shows that disabled people have been hit on average 9 times harder than other people by cuts. And if you're severely disabled, that goes up to a staggering 19 times harder than other citizens. So, of course, the government will put out those spin lines. But I think it's really beyond dispute that disabled people have taken what are in many ways devastating hits, whether that's through disability benefits or the removal of social care or cuts to housing support.
But is this, Francis, a deliberate targeting of the people who are our most vulnerable and the least likely to be able to fight back? Could any government or society really be that cruel?
I think what we saw very clearly around the start of austerity coming in, so around 2012, was this shift in language towards and about disabled people. So we saw government ministers start to really openly talking in really disturbing terms about disabled people. For example, talking about work shy, long-term sick, the suggestion being that there are these hordes of disabled people who are refusing to work, not because they can't get out of bed in the morning, but because they're just lazy and want to milk the taxpayers' money. And at the same time, we saw this shift in reporting from sections of the media. We saw these sort of front pages dedicated to so-called scrounging disabled people. We saw, you know, campaigns about driving out the local so-called benefit cheats in your area who was faking being sick for money. So I think we've seen very much this shift in recent years that has taken a suspicious tone towards disabled people that's had a real impact, not just in justifying the policies that have come about to take support from disabled people, but I think for a lot of people with health conditions in this country, they've witnessed a sort of a daily fear, if you like. I talk to people who are, you know, yelled at in the street, in their wheelchair, accused of faking their disability for money. We've seen that shift, I think, in attitudes and that legitimisation of these sort of attitudes. When ministers talk in these terms, when newspapers talk in these terms, it sort of excuses and normalises this attitude that members of the public are willing to also follow.
Can we just talk nitty-gritty, if you like? There is a cost, as you outline in the book, to being disabled, isn't there? You need specialist food, for example. You might need additional heating, your travel expenses, all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So disability on average costs around £500 extra a month. And if you're severely disabled, that can be as much as £1,000 extra a month. So as well as paying, you know, your rent and food like everyone else, as you say, you have to meet additional costs depending on your disability. Anything, you know, from extra heating to specialist food to buying your own wheelchair. And that has a real impact on people's lives. It pushes people into poverty simply because they're disabled, which is why the safety nets that the government provides is so, so important, and why cuts to disability benefits in recent years have had such a devastating effect.
Tell me about some of the women you spoke to for the book.
Absolutely. So in the book, I talked to around a dozen disabled people as really the heart of the sort of the human impact of the policies I'm talking about. And, you know, I've been sort of researching this for several years, and I was still shocked talking to some of these women about just the level of hardship that they're now going through due to these cuts. One woman, Rachel, who uses a wheelchair in the New Forest, and she's been living, you know, happily, healthily, independently in her own bungalow with a team of personal assistants provided by her local authorities through the social care system. But when the cuts to social care started coming in a few years ago, she watched her social care essentially be, you know, cut. So she lost a person that helped her cook meals and for her to eat. She lost a person that would help her get washed and dressed. Then she lost a person that came to help her get into bed at night. And in the end, she had no social care at all. And when I spoke to her, she had reached the point where her doctor told her she was now clinically malnourished because she was no longer having support to have hot meals. She told me that because there was no one to help her into bed at night, on her worst days, she was sleeping fully clothed in her wheelchair. And I think that story just really stood out for me, that isn't just a little cut. That's a treatment of disabled people that I don't think you'd wish on an animal, but is currently happening all over the country.
You also write powerfully about a catch-22 situation where a mother might be identified as somebody who isn't, and I'm using, there are speech marks here, but isn't quite disabled enough to get benefits, but is not quite able either to care properly for her children. What about that?
So I think whether it's the social care system, whether it's children's services, whether it's benefits, there's this real difficulty on disability that so often people find themselves classed by the government as not disabled enough in order to gain support, but at the same time classed as too disabled to be able to do something, whether that's being judged as being capable of looking after their own children or whether they're judged as being able to gain employment. In the book, I look at how that affects disabled mums with children, which is a real issue that I think we're really not talking about, but is incredibly important. The way that social care, for example, is really important for some disabled mums, because, say, if you find it hard to clean your house because you're in a depressive episode, a social care assistant might help you clean that home, and therefore your child is judged by social services as being in a happy and healthy home. But if that social care is cut, disabled women are finding that actually social services are then doubting their ability to look after their children. In some extreme cases, their children are actually being removed from the home. And that's a real example, I think, of just what an impact funding cuts have. If disabled people are supported by the state, they can live happy, healthy, fulfilling lives that contribute to society.
And presumably,
if you pull those strands of support away, then
it's substantially harder to do so, clearly. But there must be situations, Frances, in which children, child carers, are obliged these days to pick up the slack.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's another one of those issues that we know is happening, but we kind of normalise it, I think. You know, figures for child carers are difficult because a lot of families don't want to admit that they're having to live like that. But it's estimated that around 700,000 child carers in the country. And that is essentially, you know, we're expecting children to plug the gap of the social care crisis. Some of these children are as young as 5 or 6 doing things like getting medication for their parents because their parents are in such desperate states that their children are the only ones that are able to do this. You know, I've spoken to teenagers who can barely reach the shelves at the supermarket but are having to do the cooking, are having to learn that the oven will burn them, but they have to make the meals because if they didn't do it, the whole family wouldn't get fed. These are loving, close-knit families, but at the same time have been left in this situation just because the state isn't doing its duty towards them.
But Frances, listeners will point to that figure I mentioned right at the start, £55 billion a year of our money, taxpayers' money, spent on this. What are your alternative ideas? What's the solution?
I think those sort of figures and those sort of binary taxpayer versus disabled people is actually one of the key issues that we need to address. Because, you know, disabled people are not burden on the state. We pay tax just like anybody else. And if we're not able to pay income tax because we're too sick to work, that isn't a negative. We have just as much right as anyone in society to lead a healthy and happy life. And I think it benefits all of us to have a well-funded safety net. One of the most basic tenets of a civilised society is to say in times of sickness and disability, the state will be there to support us. And I think that we are in a situation where we are seeing that the cost cutting of the last decade hasn't done any good. It's on a human level pushed people into living in situations that are obscene levels of hardship. But on an economic level, it's such an incredible waste of money. If you cut the support that, for example, someone needs social care to help them get dressed and go to work in the morning, but you pull that assistance from them, they can't go to work anymore and they can't pay tax. Austerity is short-term economic thinking that endangers disabled people's lives, but doesn't save money, it just wastes it.
Thank you very much. That's the view of Dr. Francis Ryan, author of Crippled, Austerity and the Demonisation of Disabled People. That's the title of the book. Your thoughts welcome at BBC Women's Hour on social media, or you can email us, of course, via the website. It is, as you'll know by now, a huge summer for women's sport. The Football World Cup starts on Friday, and the big game, I suppose, domestically for us is that Scotland play England on Sunday. And the Netball World Cup is in Liverpool in July. There'll be coverage on Women's Hour of that. But this week, we're hearing from coaches across a range of sports, and we're starting this morning with Gemma Lumsdane, who's a wheelchair basketball coach at Dundee Dragons Club. Now, Gemma has won numerous awards. She's also a wheelchair rugby player and she studies at Abertay University. Jack Phillimore met her and some of the athletes she's coaching.
Sport and wheelchair basketball has given me so much in my life, and I wanted to be able to give back to the sport but also to help other people experience the same benefits that I've had, and basically to share my passion and help to improve people's lives. It's been a natural progression for me through playing and then taking more of a leadership role and then through to, like, a lead coach as well. I was born 12 weeks premature, and this resulted in me having a condition called cerebral palsy, and this affects my mobility and my coordination in all four of my limbs. So I first started playing sport in 2013 with the Dragons, actually. Sport for me has given me a sense of purpose. It's given me something to work towards, obviously a sense of identity as well. And with the team sport element, you've got the social aspect as well. And that can be great, especially for young people in terms of making friendships, building confidence and stuff like that. There are so many physical, mental and emotional benefits of sport and physical activity, and that it's just a really positive thing for people to get involved with. The main benefit that I get from coaching is seeing participants come in with low confidence, low self-esteem, not believing in themselves, and seeing them grow as people. And obviously you see their skills develop, like, on the court, but seeing them developing confidence, self-esteem, things like that, that's invaluable. And for me as a coach, that's what I work towards. At the end of the day, if you're making a difference and an impact on someone's life, that's more valuable than being able to shoot a hoop or, you know, kick a ball.
I'm Jay, and I'm 47 this year, and I'm with Dundee Dragons Wheelchair Sports Club. I started playing sport when I was about 8 years old. I was able-bodied then, and I was running around, playing hockey. I was cycling on my own time, running. However, in my 20s, I went into the wheelchair, and spina bifida was the reason that I went into the wheelchair. I was born with it. I started playing sport again in my 40s. never too old to take it up again. Started playing basketball and rugby league. A bit of tennis, a bit of badminton, give everything a go. And it's life-changing. I've got friends, I've got a social group. My health is a lot better, my physical health, my mental health, everything. As a player, I would like my coach to realise, if it's a team sport, yes, we are all there together as a team, we support one another, but within that team we're all individuals. We'll have individual needs, we'll have individual things going on in our lives. But a coach that understands, that can communicate well, that is supportive, but is honest.
Hi, I'm Paula. I'm a mum to Ben and Owen.
What do you think your boys need from a coach?
Somebody that's dedicated but also knows the individual person. Gemma's very good at knowing the individual people that play. The coach is a very key part. It's like your mama bear or your daddy bear. They are very good for everybody.
My name's Ben, I'm 17. I've been playing wheelchair basketball for about 4 years.
What made you get into basketball?
Well, I had a rare bone cancer in my left leg, and then I used to do judo and football and rugby and all that, but I couldn't do that anymore. And then I started playing basketball on my feet and that, but I wasn't, like, really good at it, and I couldn't, like, go any further. Wheelchair basketball was, like, the someone came and showed that, and that was it.
My name's Owen, I'm 14 and I've been playing wheelchair basketball for about 3-4 years. Ben's my brother. When he wasn't able to play basketball, it sort of meant that we couldn't really do sports together. And then when wheelchair basketball just came in, it just like opened doors for the both of us.
When I first started, I found it quite daunting. On a one-to-one basis, I felt quite confident, but when I had to go in front of a crowd of people and direct, and especially within the club that I'm at, quite a lot of the participants are older than me, and I was even younger at the time. So for me to basically tell people who are, you know, 20 years older than me what to do and basically try and correct their technique, you know, that's quite a daunting thing in terms of authority-wise and stuff. One of the interesting things about disability sport is everyone's got different impairments, and within the sport you've got to kind of understand how the impairments affect people's ability to play the sport and how it affects their skills. So as a coach, you've got to be able to adapt to people's strengths and weaknesses, and I would say that's a kind of challenging thing when you first come across it, because you don't know what people can do and you don't know how to really adapt things to suit them. So people with my disability I was a bit more clued up on, but I had to like learn about all these different disabilities, and obviously everyone's affected differently, but you know, everyone has been really great in terms of respect, and there's that mutual respect between myself and the participants, and that's one thing that I try to make really clear. With anyone that I coach, is, you know, I respect them as much as they respect me. So,
my name's Nathaniel and I'm 11 years old, and I've been playing basketball for 2 years, almost three. I only started using the wheelchair when I got into wheelchair basketball, because I'm an amputee and I usually use my prosthesis most of the time.
And how have you found taking on this sport? What do you enjoy about it?
I enjoy like all like the leagues and competitions we have, and I enjoy like playing with like my friends and practicing and training with them.
What do you think you need personally from a coach?
Like, they're generous and like they're nice. Because Gemma's like always really kind, and she takes stuff really gently. She doesn't just like, right, go do this.
Obviously, I'm female as well. You know, the club that I coach at is very inclusive, very open and welcoming, but I think a lot of female coaches maybe feel quite intimidated when they're coaching male athletes or participants, or, you know, if there's other male coaches around them.
I started coaching my daughter's football team on Saturdays because my husband said, well, hang on a minute, we're both working, why aren't you sharing the coaching with me? So, I started getting up at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning and doing it. And I never realised what it would give me. I just thought it would be, you know, doing my duty. Now I absolutely love it, and he doesn't actually get a chance to go because I do it every week. I'm coaching with other men. And when I made that step, I felt like, am I going to know as much as them? Am I going to be listened to as much as them? I felt all these kind of niggling.
Obviously, when you're starting off, it is really daunting, but the more that you do it and the more kind of experience you get of different situations, the easier it gets.
When you were learning the sport, did you have many female lead role models?
I was quite lucky because my coach and the person who actually got me involved in the sport, Tina, she's been a great role model for me. With more female coaches, that's going to encourage more female participation, which female participation will then lead to more female coaches, so it's a bit of a cycle really, and that's super important. The best coaches that I know, the real person-centred people, and they have this sense of belief, and the way that they kind of put that across somehow seeps through into you, and even if you don't believe in yourself, then from them they begin to help you believe in yourself, and I think that's really important. You know, obviously everyone's going to have setbacks, everyone's going to have bad days, good days, and an important part of being a coach is being able to support the participants and the athletes through that, you know.
If it wasn't for volunteers, such as with Gemma, a lot of these clubs wouldn't exist, because it is usually mums and dads and other people that play in the club that give up their time to help out and be coaches. So it's very important.
Because of coaching, I'm a lot more confident and I'm able to present myself in a good light and in the way that I want to be presented. And also I've had opportunities to present and do bits of public speaking and things like that, and I feel without the coaching I probably wouldn't have as much confidence to get up and speak in front of a whole lot of people.
Really important to acknowledge those people who are willing to give up their time to help other people, and they include Gemma Lumsdane, who is that wheelchair basketball coach you just heard from at Dundee Dragons Club. And that report was by Jack Phillimore. And on the programme tomorrow, we're going to be previewing the Women's Football World Cup, and there'll be more sports coaches scattered throughout the week on Women's Hour. Now, Eli Kitali, is from the East African country of Tanzania, and she gave birth to her son Chadron 4 years ago. He has Down syndrome. Now, she realised she hardly ever saw other children like him around the town or at social events or at church, and Eli felt that parents might well be hiding their children. When Eli started talking to other mothers, they told her about the shame they were made to feel for having a child with Down syndrome. But also, importantly, they told her about their determination to start to change things.
This is Jotham. Jotham. Hi! Jotham. How are you, Baba? You're just like my son.
Today I'm here with my friend Margaret.
Neighbours, relatives, how did they accept Jotham?
Some of them judges us that we have used our son for money ritual so that we can be rich.
In Tanzania, you can go to a witch doctor and ask them to cast a spell for something you want, like money or power. The witch doctor will ask you for a sacrifice. So you could ask the witch doctor to make you rich and sacrifice your own child's mental capabilities. That's what people who don't know parents of children with Down syndrome think we have done. But of course, we haven't done this.
I remember one day I was feeding my baby and the text message came. Shame on you people. Oh, you no. Have used your son for money ritual so that you can become rich.
And what did you do?
I couldn't even continue to feed the baby. I remember I cried a lot. I called my husband and I told him, someone we know, our friend. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I felt so angry. I want the world to know that mothers like us did not do anything to influence whether we have children with Down syndrome.
I was not comfortable to go to the street or public areas with my son because some people, they were looking at me as if I'm a sinful person. But now I came to realize this is my situation and I have to bear it. I'm happy with the way my son is. I don't care how the look I get from outside there.
You hardly ever see children with Down syndrome in public. This is one of the things that make it even harder as a mother. We found one woman whose own husband had accused her of going to the witch doctor. She doesn't want to be identified, so we'll call her son Baraka.
There was a time I just used to keep my child indoors. My husband said the child wasn't his. He said that I had taken Baraka to the witch doctor to make him like this. He stopped bringing his friends to the house. He was ashamed. His family suggested the Down syndrome came from my side of the family, and he stopped taking us to his family gatherings.
She says she had no choice but to lock her son in the house.
My husband never pays for anything for Baraka, so I have to earn my own money. I started going to the market to sell vegetables. When Baraka went outside, the neighbors would call him names, saying he was crazy. So I locked him in the house when I went to work. But I did take Baraka to church every Sunday. One day, on the bus ride home, another mother told me about a special school. He enrolled and is now doing better.
Two, three, four, five.
Baraka is now 9 years old, and this woman's husband still doesn't let her take him to his family's gatherings. Both rich and poor are pressured to keep their children away from social events. I met 19-year-old Samuel.
Mimi naitwa Samueli Philip Edward Mwanyika.
He said his name is Sam Edward Mwanyika. His mother, Sophie, takes him everywhere. How do people react when you take Sam to public events?
They're shocked. One day I went to the wedding of one of my friends with Sam. People was just watching at him. My friends asked me, are you comfortable coming to the event like this with Sam? I said, yes, I'm comfortable. They said, you are a very tough woman. They told me that there's one of their friends have a son like Samuel. They used to lock in the room and they wash him by throwing a water from far away because they don't want even to touch him.
Some friends are telling me you can use these types of herbs to help your son to be better. Have you ever come across such things?
What people advised us is to go to the witch doctor.
What kind of medicines did the witch doctor give?
So many things like dried tree leaves and to use the oil from the head to the knees. It was so expensive. We believe that Samuel will be healed of Down syndrome, which is not true.
It's interesting that Sophie used to think she could cure Down syndrome. Not understanding the cause of Downs seems to be at the root of all the beliefs I've heard so far. It's something Dr. Isaac Marrow has to deal with when parents come to see him. I met him at Dar es Salaam's main hospital.
Most people believe that it ranges from a curse to being bewitched to incest.
How do you explain it to them that it's not something to do with the beliefs?
It's very easy to tell them that this is not only your child, and this is not only in Tanzania. If you see a Japanese child with Down syndrome, they'll be the same as your child. So you cannot tell me that your child has been bewitched by the same person who bewitched the guy in Japan. It doesn't work that way. And I show them the pictures as well. I usually tell them that it's genetical, and you can see it has nothing to do with you or you. It just happened, so you don't have anyone to blame.
Children with Downs can learn if they're given the chance and not hidden away. Teacher Eliambuya Shao told me that the villagers have started to notice the difference education makes and they've taken action.
Baada ya watu kuona jinsi wale watoto pale kituoni wamechangamka wamebadilika.
So she just said that there is a boy who was being hidden by his parents. The villagers saw that the school is making so much difference with these children. So they came up to them and tell them, you know, there's a boy in this house that has been hidden for a very long time. Maybe you should go and look out if you can bring him to the school. So they went there, but the father was strongly rejecting the idea. So they had to even consult the local government to help them. And finally, they managed to persuade him. And he joined and he completely changed when he went to school.
Sasa wanamfurahia kwa sababu wanaweza kumtuma hata.
The parents have really changed. They accept the child very well. They are very happy that he can do so many things. And they even now teach other parents, please do not hide your child because we were doing that and it didn't work. So they are kind of joined the forces with them to change the environment. So the change has been really good.
And you can hear the full programme, Don't Hide My Son. It's on the BBC World Service tomorrow at 1:30, or of course you can hear it via BBC Sounds. Now, Juno Dawson, the novelist, is here. Juno, good morning to you.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you for having me.
Well, you're young adult novelist, that's what you are.
Yes.
Is that all right with you, that term?
Yeah, I love writing YA fiction. I think, you know, it's some of the most sort of provocative and current and challenging stuff out there. It's just, I think a lot of people are put off by the label and think it's for kids. But of course, for me, the key word is adult. So it's just young adults. And how do you define that?
Yeah. Well, how old are your readers? Do you know?
Well, I thought they were teenagers, but my last book, Clean, it won a big award with Cosmopolitan, and that was voted for by readers of Cosmo, which I guess are women in their 20s.
And that was about addiction, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was, about a girl in rehab.
Yeah, it was pretty unsparing.
It was quite unflinching, yeah. And I think, but you know, I'm a huge fan of, you know, books by authors like Louise O'Neill, Patrick Ness, Philip Pullman, and I think, you know, we can get away with a lot when you say it's for young adults.
Because today's young adults, teenagers, have seen and heard so much more certainly than when I was that age.
Yeah, and I will never know what it was like to have Instagram as a teenager. And, you know, if you are now 17 years old, you've kind of had an iPad or an iPhone your whole life. Yeah. And, you know, you've had unfiltered access to the internet. And so I think we've got to be very careful as adults that we don't put rose-coloured glasses over this mythical state of childhood, because that state, I don't know if it exists anymore.
No, I'm not sure anybody's making daisy chains, or perhaps they are, in which case you can tell
so.
Us at BBC Woman's Hour. So this new one is called Meat Market. It's about modelling. Now, modelling is something we've talked about on Woman's Hour before. We've talked about London Fashion Week. I remember interviewing Leomi Anderson a couple of years ago, and she was really, I think, an important voice on how women of colour are treated in modelling. What do you now know about the modelling industry that you didn't know before?
So it was funny, it came about this book from when I moved to London, just through my friends and people I was working with, and I had a column in a fashion magazine as well. It was just hearing the horror stories, and it was the way they were related very matter-of-factly about women having burns on their faces and on their heads, having had their hair pulled out, having been told a myriad of ways to lose weight without ever being told to lose weight. You know, you're told to juice, or you're told to fast, or you're told to tone up. And it was the way they spoke about that as if it was normal. And, you know, it was just from collecting those horror stories that I started to get the idea of, you know, telling a story that focused on one girl from the moment she's scouted up until really the point where something really horrific happens to her.
And actually, she struggles to know quite what has happened to her, doesn't she? Which I think is a really important element of the book.
Yeah. So the story is about a girl called Yana. She's a girl from southwest London. And the pivot point of the novel is where she's sexually assaulted by a very important man in the fashion industry in a hotel room. But right from the beginning, I always knew that I wanted to put her in a situation that I'd been in a situation that a lot of my friends had been in, where you kind of come away thinking, did that just happen? Like, was that okay? Yeah. Was that legal? Like, should I go to the police about that? And I don't think there's many young women that I haven't spoken to who haven't been in that sort of, I don't even want to call it a grey area, because it's not a grey area. It's not okay.
Except it might be in your mind as an adolescent, because you don't know. You're not quite sure.
Yeah, and I think the way that the media has shown sexual assault and rape for a really long time has, we've seen one sort of story, and very often it's the narrative of the bogeyman jumping out of a bush, and in reality that's often not what rape and sexual assault is like. The rapist looks like your boyfriend or your best friend or a friend of a friend or even a family member. And so that's why I deliberately put Yana in a situation where she comes away from it, and initially she blames herself. She thinks she's going to be in trouble with her agency.
Yeah, let's go back a little bit. Yana is, she's a South London girl, I think, isn't she?
Yeah, so she wasn't to begin with. In the first draft, I was very keen to make her sort of the girl next door so that lots of my readers could identify with her. But at the time, I was living on the Winstanley estate right behind Clapham Junction Station. And the best research you can do as a YA novelist is just listening to girls on the bus. And I started to realise I'd never really seen a lot of girls like the Winstanley girls in a book, and certainly not in one of my books. So about maybe 100 pages in, I went back and started again and made her just a girl off the Winstanley.
Yeah, this is why I'm not a novelist, because I just couldn't be bothered going back to do it all again, Juno, to be honest with you. I'd just stick with the original. But you're right, she's a very plausible voice, and a friendship group seems authentic to me. I've got a couple of teenage girls, and that all seems like it would be happening. It could be happening. Her friends are rather supportive of her foray into modelling. And it's important to Yana because it's important to her family. They need the money, don't they?
Yeah, and that really changed the book for me as well. I started to think, you know, why is she doing this? And Yana, she's not nice. She's in some ways she's naive, but in other ways quite streetwise. But I did think at one point, why would she put herself through this? And then I thought, well, it's London. It's really expensive. And actually, I won't say who the real model was, but one model that I spoke to said to me, can you think of any other job where an 18-year-old girl can earn £10,000 in a day?
And they can.
And I was like, no, I can't think of any other job. And that's why they do it, because even if you're a girl who's not making that much money, that's the carrot they dangle over you. Like, that big campaign could be just around the corner. Just keep on doing these really low paid jobs where they pay you in clothes or makeup, because the next job might be the big 30, 40 grand campaign with a big major label.
They are told, aren't they, to stay thin, to keep thin, to get thin.
Yes. And I think, you know, what struck me, and the girls kind of laugh about it, is the ways that they're never told directly, you need to be skinnier.
How is it phrased?
It's always like, tone up, or, you know, what the question, what are you eating? What's your diet like? What did you have for
breakfast?
Who
asks these questions?
Well, it's a mixture of people. It's kind of, and I think there's a bit of a diffusion of responsibilities, like who should be looking after these girls. So it's their agents. Their agents are terrified of casting agents. The casting agents are living in fear of directors and runway producers. So there's a real hierarchy. And so sometimes, I think, when I spoke to those people, there was none of these people are aware of the damage they're necessarily inflicting. I think they all think they're looking after these girls. And very often they will say, oh, these girls are like my sisters, these girls are like my babies, these girls are like my daughters. And they always pass the blame to the next person. Like, oh, we would never tell you to lose weight, but that designer will.
So you'd better lose weight.
So you'd better lose weight.
And in the old days, well, the defence was always the clothes look better on girls who are 5'10" and what is it, a size 6?
They wouldn't want you much bigger than a size 6 for runway, which is terrifying. How can you be 5'11" and a size 6?
Well, you can't, not healthily, surely.
I mean, there are, I mean, that's the other thing as well. The girls, you know, these are girls who are recruited from Siberia. And what fascinates me about this career is that you can't choose to be a model. You know, you either are 5'11 and a size 6, or you're not.
And you're never going to be, are you? And
so you can't really work towards it. And all the girls, you know, to look like that, they are in some way, you know, you can't train to be 5'11". They just are. But at the same time, it almost feels like there is no such thing as too thin. And when you're in that very high pressure industry where you're being shipped around the world, the one thing you can control is what you're eating. Mm-hmm. And so there is, and I heard one model say, you know, there is a real power in skinniness. And, you know, you can't control anything else, but you can be the thinnest girl at that casting. And that obviously is incredibly dangerous thinking.
But Instagram, you think, might be making a difference. Can you explain why?
I hope so. I mean, I think obviously I'm sure you've talked about a lot of the whole body positivity movement. And what I love about Instagram is that it's removed some of the gatekeepers. We can be the casting agent and we can choose what kind of body we want to see in our feed. And certainly I made sure when I was working on this book that I wasn't just following very young white girls, that I wanted to look at curvy girls, shorter girls, girls with disabilities, you know, There are role models for everyone. There are trans models, there are lesbian models. You can find somebody who looks like anything you want. And that's, so I think slightly beauty and fashion has been democratised by social media.
And have you had criticism? I'm not criticising, I'm asking. Have you had criticism because you haven't got a trans character in this book? You're a trans woman yourself.
Yeah.
Has anybody said it?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting. There was a point, and I say a point, it was about a minute, where I did think this story could work with Yana as trans, because there are trans models working in the industry. Teddy Quinlivan, Harry Neff, Ariel Nicholson, Maxim May, just to name a few. So Yana could have easily been trans, but it would have changed. I wanted this story to be as universal as possible. You know, this isn't an expose. It's Yana's story. It's about one girl who goes through this horrific experience and about her decision to speak out and the ramifications that has. And I knew that Yana's experience in that hotel room is really universal. And I think had I made her trans, that would have changed her journey through the fashion industry a bit and would have maybe ended up being like a coming out novel. And so I wanted to make it as central as possible.
Yeah.
But I'm working on the TV show now. In the TV show, there will absolutely be a trans character. So we can do that later.
Juno, thank you very much.
You.
I should say that she has a supportive relationship with her boyfriend, Ferdy, who just seems like a nice lad.
I love him, yes.
Yeah, thank you very much,
thank
Juno.
You.
Meat Market is the name of the book. Juno Dawson, author of Meat Market, which, as she explains there, is coming to a telescreen near you at some point in the relatively near future. Now, Daisy Chains actually cropped up at some point in that conversation, and at least one listener has contacted the show to say, Chloe, my youngest daughter, aged 12, stopped me from mowing the lawn during half term so she could teach her friend to make a daisy chain. Her friend is also 12 and had never made one before. There you go. People are still making daisy chains and teaching their friends to do exactly that as well. To your thoughts then on the interview with Frances Ryan this morning. Ali says, I can totally relate to Frances Ryan's assessment that many women are both too disabled and not disabled enough, so-called, for the current government and wider society. A couple of years ago, at almost exactly the same time as my benefits completely dropped away in the move from disability living allowance to personal independence payment, money that allowed me to have and maintain a car, which is my lifeline to my independence, I was refused to be allowed to adopt a child by my local authority as a direct consequence of having a disability. Both events were extremely distressing and emotionally painful. And if it wasn't for the support of my family and friends and other resources I could draw on, I think I'd have ended up having a much bigger burden on the state in terms of my mental health and inability to earn a living. Both events still hurt a great deal. From Gillian, I have dwarfism and I was awarded lifetime disability living allowance 20 years ago. But now my DLA is being cut and changed to PIP. I'm terrified they're going to remove this from me. My disability affects me more now than it did 20 years ago, yet I'm likely to get less. I trained as a primary school teacher and did this for 5 years, but had to give it up as it was too much. I now do a job private tutoring. The costs that Frances Ryan described sound like an exaggeration, but they're not. It's a truly terrifying time for people with disabilities. Claire says, I agree with Frances Ryan's point about the demonisation of disabled people, and I think a fundamental lack of understanding of the varied and complex needs of disabled people who may have multiple disabilities and health issues is a key factor. My brother has learning disabilities, and at the end of a lengthy phone conversation about his disability assessment, the DWP advisor said, I hope your brother gets better soon. From Kate, I'm a disabled woman. I've been on disability living allowance for 27 years, mobility and care. I've just been reassessed for PIP and I've lost my benefit and therefore my blue badge as well. I don't know how I'm going to manage losing around £4,000 a year. I go out about once a week, but now without my blue badge, I can't get to places. I'm too ill and tired and stressed to fight this. Kate, I'm sorry to hear about that. There is always another side, and let me bring in the other side now. Morag says, that was a very poor interview by Jane Garvey on the subject of cuts to disability benefits. There was absolutely no effort on her part to find out the reasons why disability benefits had to change. When I was in charge of special needs in a comprehensive school in a deprived area, I had parents coming to me regularly wanting me to sign their forms to get DLA. They didn't actually want to hear that their child's reading or behaviour had improved, as that would mean they may not get the benefit. They were very keen on Ritalin for ADHD, as that meant they would definitely get the benefit. There are some reasons why things had to change, but the BBC failed in its duty to present both sides of the argument. From Brian, Frances Ryan has uttered a diatribe against the current disability policies of the government. I understand there are problems and there always will be. The truth is that however much funding is made, there will be a drain with an ever-expanding plug hole for the money to pour into. Every pound spent on the disabled, and I speak as a person with a wife with multiple conditions that would be a recipient if we push for it, is possibly 70% funded by working families. Realistically, there is a finite fund of tax, and as we've seen with austerity, there'll be losers. However, as I heard on Radio 4 last week, there are recipients who are in care to whom £1,000 a week is insufficient and they need, we're told, over £1,300 to live in a special facility. I am not a taxpayer, only in receipt of pension and my wife's pension, but we live comfortably. I'm also not without compassion. I feel for people who are disabled. I have certain problems myself that limit my mobility and give pain. But I do trust that this alternative view will be noted. Thanks to everybody who contacted us today. I hope you do feel that's a reasonable representation of the variety of views expressed on this subject. But it's impossible not to feel profound sympathy for people who really are struggling at the moment. I find it very difficult to see why you wouldn't be sympathetic. Thanks to everybody. We're here tomorrow, of course, and my guests include Nicola Benedetti, the violinist.
I'm Simon Mundy, host of Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions, covering topics like resilience, tribalism, and fear with people like this.
We keep talking about fear, and to me, I always want to bring it back to, are you actually in danger?
That's Alex Honnold, star of the Oscar-winning film Free Solo, in which he climbed a 3,000-foot sheer cliff without ropes.
So, I mean, a lot of those, you know, social anxieties things, and certainly I've had a lot of issues with talking to attractive people in my life. I'm like, oh no, like I could never do that. And it certainly feels like you're going to die, but realistically you're not going to die. And that's all practice too.
Have a listen to Don't Tell Me the Score, full of useful everyday tips from incredible people on BBC Sounds.